First of all, I want to take the opportunity to anybody happening to who's listening to this and who happens to live in the upper regions of New York State and the vicinity of Syracuse to keep in mind that Jack. I'm sorry, Jack. I just forgot your last name. I'm sorry. This is stupid.
That's all right. Actually, we draw quite a larger audience than just upstate.
Jack Theakston. I'm sorry. Your name last name is Jack Theakston. I'm sorry. Anyway,
yes.
Jack Theakston has a rather novel. I wish I could actually attend this one. It's called The Capitol Fest, which will be unfolding for 3 days, August 9th, 10th, and 11th. At the Capitol Theater in Rome, New York, which is, I presume, Jack, I don't see any photos on your website of the theater, but I presume it's a well-preserved relic of the golden era, is it, or not?
It absolutely is. It's a 1928 movie palace.
Wow.
Located in upstate New York.
And
about 1,800 feet, and we draw a lot of people from all over the world for Capitol Fest. The scope of the festival is 3 days of rare, silent, and early talkie films. And we have an original installation, Moeller Theater Organ, and we have three different musicians accompany the various silent films throughout the weekend.
Uh-huh. You're talking about organ accompaniment mainly?
I'm sorry, what?
When you talk about musical accompaniment for, do you have any silence that are being accompanied by organ, or is it all talkies, Jack? I'm asking.
All of the silence are accompanied.
Okay.
And we have about six or seven various films. I think we have about five features that are silent and then various short subjects. And this year we're having, as accompanists, Dr. Phil Carley, Avery Cunningly, and Robert Israel, who's been heard on TCM many times.
You know what I'd love to see? It just came to me. I would love to see a silent film accompanied by, let's say, electric guitar and bass, electric bass, you know, something like that. Maybe.
If that's your flavor, there are actual people that are out there that do stuff like that.
Yeah.
Our festival tends to be a little bit more traditional in style, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, we all know that organ is the instrument of choice, but I would love to see some kind of variation on that, just for the fun of it, and see what happens.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And we've had orchestras here in the past.
Okay.
You know, we have an orchestra pit, so we've done an orchestral accompaniment, and,
right.
You know, but our scope is traditional presentation, so we try to stick with organ, piano, or orchestra.
Right. Now, that's funny, you know, you've got some films playing, some of the films playing. One of them is the very well-known Nothing Sacred with a great screwball, kind of ethical screwball comedy with directed by William Willman with Carol Lombard and Frederick March. And also a 35mm restored print of the original three-strip Technicolor, which would be great to see. I would love to just be at your theater just to see that. But,
we'd love to have you. All of the shows, all of the films that we run throughout the show, with the exception of maybe one or two, are all 35mm on carbon arc,
right.
Lamp houses and carbon arc projection, and with the silence, of course, we run the films at their correct speeds. We do not run everything at 24 frames per second,
right.
Which, of course, makes all the films look sped up and jerky.
Right. Now, speaking as a formerly licensed projectionist in the great state of Connecticut, can you tell me or explain to the people in general why you believe that carbon arc illumination from a projector is better than xenon or whatever new modes of light illumination we have these days?
Well, to be honest with you, I think at this point, you know, there was a point where I could tell you it was brighter, it had a better color temperature, and it was more evenly lit. Xenon's come certainly a long way since then. Of course, when we're running original archival prints, especially of dye transfer Technicolor prints, running them on carbon arc projectors is almost necessary because those prints are color timed for carbon arc projection,
yeah.
And they look most natural. but to present it that way. But yeah, generally speaking, it gives a brighter, whiter, and a more even light on the screen.
The interesting thing about, as you know, with DVDs these days, particularly the technology that was invented something like 10 years ago, I believe, in which the three strips made the Technicolor print they came up with a way to digitally align those images in a much more precise way than doable back in the original time when they came out, back in the 30s or whatever, because they were basically aligned manually with the naked eye, whereas this is a much more, so you have much sharper images. What you're showing, is this a manually aligned old-fashioned Technicolor print, or is this a new digital version?
Of Nothing Sacred?
Yeah, Nothing Sacred.
Nothing Sacred, it's a new restoration in 35mm.
Mm-hmm.
It was a photochemical restoration, it was not a digital restoration, but it was done. There are devices today that actually replace the old naked eye form of registration and alignment.
Right.
They actually tell the printer to rack the negative in a certain way.
Okay.
And this was actually restored by the Disney Corporation, who acquired, I won't say the rights because the film is public domain now, obviously, but yeah. They acquired the elements for the film through a company that bought the Selznick Library, and they in turn bought that company. And so this film that you're going to see is actually from the original three-strip negatives. And as far as I know, it's not on DVD in that form. What's on DVD through, I believe, Kino and other vendors looks good, but is from an original print that was actually David Selznick's personal print.
What, the DVD or the one that you're showing?
The DVD.
Okay. Am I wrong? Did they not recently come out with a Blu-ray of Nothing Sacred?
They did, although my understanding is that is actually a transfer from a print. But don't quote me on it. I'm not sure.
Right. Okay. Very good. No, this kind of interesting segue. The reason I brought up the registration and being able to align the three strips of a film that create the Technicolor print is because it's kind of startling in a way. It's delightful in a sense that these films, Gone with the Wind included, look sharper to our eyes today when we look at them on Blu-ray than they did to Victor Fleming or David O. Selznick or any of those people who were making those films. That we are seeing a sharper, cleaner image than even they did. Now, who would...
Oh, unquestionably.
Who among us would say, no, I don't want to see it that sharper. I want to see it. I want to appreciate that film the way David O. Selznick and Victor Fleming and Louis B. Mayer and all those guys saw it. I don't want to have it improved. I wanted to absorb it the way it was meant to be, so it was intended to be seen when it was released. What would you say to a person saying that?
I would say, first off, it is absolutely true that the Blu-rays that we have today do look sharper than a dye transfer print from the 30s or 40s ever could afford,
right,
because by nature the printing process itself had a softness to it,
right,
but also that gave it its trademark sort of velvety look.
Yeah.
I would say for the most part, sharper is better, of course, but with the one caveat that there are certain errors that, and I'm specifically thinking of Fleming on The Wizard of Oz, you would not have seen in original prints, like the string that pulls around the Cowardly Lion's tail. They knew that with the softness of the print, you wouldn't be able to see that, and now with the extra clarity added to it through the digital means, you're starting to see these things that you would have never have seen back in the 30s, of course. And Warner Brothers made a rather controversial move by doing some wire removal in that film in particular.
What are we talking about? Which wire from what film again?
This would have been The Wizard of Oz.
No, I would dispute that. I would dispute that it's controversial because As I was told, the story went that a senior Warner Brothers person, I think it might have been George Feltenstein, consulted Bob Harris, who I'm sure you know, and he said, "What is your feeling about the wires on the backs of the monkeys and the wires on the backs of the scarecrow?" And Bob's response was, and I think this is an entirely correct way of looking at it, if it wasn't visible to the audiences sitting in front of a color screen in theaters back in 1939, it should not be visible to people watching the Blu-ray today. Period. End of story.
But I'm in agreement with that. But
what makes it controversial? Why did you use the term controversial then? I don't think there's any controversy at all. The wires should not be seen.
I think it was controversial to purists who feel like even if you're removing something that was originally not seen, that the information was there and that you should see the film as it is on the film, warts and all.
But people weren't seeing. That's the point. When people were watching George Pal's War of the Worlds back in 1953, they did not see those wires holding up the Martian spaceships. But if you look at the most recent...
Not for the most part, but actually I have to refute that because I have seen two original IV prints of War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
And in several shots you can see the strings. And
they have to be not as vividly as the DVD, surely. I mean, it's unmistakable when you... I mean, I've seen War of the Worlds in a theater.
Oh, I understand. But we've actually run at my theater here the new print that Paramount has made of the film.
Yeah.
And it is more visible and obviously sharper, and you can see it better. But yes, I am of the opinion personally that wire removal is all right, but I understand that there is a camp that doesn't believe that it is. I'm not here to debate their argument for them, really.
That's one of the most ludicrous arguments I've ever heard. Let's see the warts, even though audiences of the original day didn't see them. We see them, and let's keep them out there. That's one of the stupidest things I've ever... I mean, I'd really love to actually debate that with somebody who really thinks that way. I think it was a DVD talk critic who made that argument about War of the Worlds. Even though it doesn't look right, keep those wires there. That was one of the... I just have no respect for something like that. Anyway, here's the idea.
My personal opinion... To put to tie a ribbon on that subject, mm-hmm. is that ultimately I can't think of a filmmaker who would want something like that scene. And I know it's considered sacrilegious to put words in filmmakers' mouths who are dead now, but I don't think you would find any filmmaker who would have been against wire removal from that period.
Yeah. Okay. By the same token, and we can segue here into the On the Waterfront Blu-ray, which is what I feel is between... There are two significant DVD Blu-rays that have interfered and I think discredited the Bob Furmanek approach to interpreting and advising DVD distribution companies to adhere to the originally intended theatrical aspect ratio of those films. One is the Masters of Cinema Blu-ray of Touch of Evil, which did a great service to fans of that film by including, was it two aspect ratios? I believe it was 1.33, or 1.37, one of the two, as well as a 1.85, respecting that there was a 1.85 aspect ratio, of course, in place in theaters by 1958 when Touch of Evil came out. But they also decided that the composition of the frames, and it's apparently something to do with Orson Welles' intention or the way he framed the 1.33, they decided to represent that also, so you can see both of them, which I think is brilliant. I don't mind that people recreate the way the film was most likely in the vast majority of instances shown, which is 1.85, but I love having those 1.33 compositions for that era, because that was a transitional era in which... the industry had been working with basically a boxy aspect ratio from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and early 50s. And then, just like that, the studio said, okay, forget all that boxy stuff. We have to look better than television. We have to look, we have to deliver some kind of visual element that tells you you're not watching this on TV. This is better, this is wider, this is more vivid. So we're going to take the aperture plate that we're handing out to you guys. You'll see them in the mail very soon. Put those things in and adjust your throws and make sure that the image comes out with a 1.85, and that'll really tell the average Joe's paying to see our movies, wow, this doesn't look like TV. This is, you know, wider. So, I mean, that was a tactical move by the distribution people and exhibitors, of course, to enhance the movie-going experience. That's all it was. It was as Francis Coppola described to me in a chat that I had with him in, I believe it was 81, when One from the Heart was coming out, and he had decided to show that film in 1.33. He said that, in his view, that 1.85 is nothing but an exhibitor scam, simply to deliver the impression that you're seeing something significantly different and more cinematic and cooler than a television image, which of course is, you know, more or less the same boxy, you know, image. The other, one more quick thing, and the other thing, of course, is the upcoming, soon-to-be-seen On the Waterfront Blu-ray, and that is went even beyond what I would have hoped for, and they are not only just presenting the 1.85 image, which I understand was the way it was seen at the Astor and other major theaters, and for all I know, across the country, although I doubt severely that it was put that way, because the country is most projectionists are very slow and very conservative, and you know, not going to come around instantly to what the studio requires. But let's just, you know, rhetorically say that it was probably shown in 1.85. But Criterion has also decided, and I was blew my mind when they said this, we're also going to present 1.66:1 versions, and we're also going to present a 1.3C. Three separate versions of On the Waterfront. Now, when I heard that, I said, this is a statement by one of the most purist, cinematic-minded keepers of the flame, that they don't believe in the 1.85 dogma of Bob Firmenich. So that's why. What do you have to say to all that? And what is flawed or wrong about my impressions of this?
Well, first I'll just state, as in regard to Criterion releasing it in these three formats, I think it's actually, first off, a fascinating example of something like this happening. I think it makes for educationally an interesting sort of a format. But ultimately, I think this is not a decision necessarily an artistic one, but a commercial decision that people who are buying this release may be of the impression, in my opinion, wrongly so, that 1.37 is the correct way to screen the film. And I think they're heeding Grover Crisp, who works at Sony Pictures. He's the head of the restoration department there.
Yes, I've known Grover Crisp and respect that man as one of the great figures of our time in terms of restorations. He's a brilliant fellow. But let me just tell you one quick thing before you keep going. Grover Crisp, when he mastered or prepared On the Waterfront for a new DVD, which I don't know, I forget when it was, sometime around maybe 03 or something, or 04, I can't remember, but I asked if I could possibly, he said he was having a screening of it, okay? And it was going to be on the lot. Or maybe he even did it for me personally, but I think it was me and maybe three other people, and it was in the Jimmy Stewart room. And I said, I would love to see this digitally improved version of On the Waterfront. So I went to the Sony lot and I saw it. Guess what? He showed it. it was projected at 1.33 or 1.37. 1.37. So, you know, Grover Crisp, as Bob told me, said that he thinks that the proper way to see this film is 1.66. You know, I don't even know what the basis for that is. I thought it was, according to Bob Firmenich, it's 1.85. Grover Crisp is saying 1.66. He showed it to me at 1.33. It just seems like it's all over the map. I don't dispute Mr. Firmenich's research. He's very meticulous. He really knows his stuff. He goes back and finds exactly what was shown. There's no question about that. But why the variations? That's what we're trying to discuss.
Well, you're talking about the element of human opinion, for one thing, what people artistically think is correct versus what the artist's intention was. You know, I splatter some red paint on a canvas and without any reason or any thought behind it. looks into it and says it's genius. It's a statement on the counterculture of the 60s. You know, artistic opinions are about as useful as the paper that they're written on.
Okay, well, all right, you're saying that my opinion is my opinion. Fine. But why do you? I mean, I'm just trying to get down to the number of it here. I believe that if the image is taller and boxier and it provides more visual information, clearly it was shot that way to allow for. I don't care what anybody says. I believe that anybody shooting movies in 1953, which is when the widescreen, of April of 53, I believe, is when the widescreen thing was introduced. Anybody shooting at that time who didn't believe that their film would eventually be, would A, be shown in many theaters with the old aspect ratios. They know that the entire exhibition industry is not going to switch over instantly to 1.85. And secondly, anybody who's shooting in 1953 who didn't understand that eventually, down the road, their film would be shown on television, and they had no understanding that there would be such a thing as widescreen televisions or 16:9, so they shot it with the idea that it would have to fit that format. So all smart directors, if you've ever, I'm sure you've seen it, you know how all films are shot, you shoot it for, it's protected for 1 through 3, but you shoot it with the idea that it'll primarily be seen at 1.85, but you protect it for the higher. So I don't see what the problem is, and why would anybody want to see less of a film? Why? We'd rather see the tops chopped off. Why is that a good thing? And tell me, just give me a hint.
For one thing, Jeff, if I can interject here.
I'm sorry, I'm talking too much.
I can give you. It's all right. I can interject here that, for example, I can give you another example of something that you, I'm sure, and a number of your listeners may not actually be aware of, which is there are a slew of films, and have been since the 30s, right, in which the picture negative is actually shot with a silent aperture. It's actually shot from, it actually shoots in the area that eventually will be printed over by the soundtrack in the printer. That's a holdover from the silent era. Cameras that were made to shoot that way. It also has to do with some technological things that have to do with color printing, but you know, by this token of let's present all these things open, Matt, let's start transferring these films that were shot this way with the extra image on the side and throw all the compositions off to the right of the screen.
Well, I don't think that's right. I think we any good DP and any good director would want people to understand that he or she understood balance and aesthetic, perfection in terms of capturing. I wouldn't want to have a lopsided.
I certainly agree. Yeah. And that's why I believe that when, to me, it's obvious that a film was shot for flat wide screen, that there's an abundance of headroom, and not just an abundance of headroom, but an abundance of headroom that just coincidentally lies exactly where the top of a 1.85 frame would lie.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah.
And the composition, of course. I mean, of course, cinematographers and photographers compose their shots with the rule of thirds. And if you apply the rule of thirds to most 1.85 films, you'll see things rest quite comfortably. People's eye lines usually drop in close-up shots to the top third line, and their mouths drop at the bottom third line, I guess, for extreme close-ups.
Mm-hmm.
I think the confusion in some cases lies in the part where you have extreme close-ups. And, of course, in the case of On the Waterfront, Kazan was really known for shooting with extreme close-ups on the actors' faces to get all of their emotions registered.
Right.
Something that in a 1.37 presentation could look like just a close-up shot because the head reaches the top of the frame, when you crop it down to 1.85, is actually an extreme close-up and registers quite well on a wide screen, of course. And this is a technique that you see not only in flat films, but in scope films from the period. I also think it's interesting that Kazan's next film, East of Eden, was shot in CinemaScope. So obviously he had no qualms about shooting in widescreen.
In fact, I kind of love that Ilya Kazan use a couple of Dutch angles in East of Eden. He'd tilt the camera slightly to give a kind of a feeling of psychological or emotional upheaval or dislocation. I mean, he was an exciting filmmaker. He was on top of it all the way, and I wanted to also tribute him, his framings. I've seen the 185 version of On the Waterfront. It's on iTunes. He knew what he was doing. That framing for 185 looks good. I mean, he knows exactly how to deliver a good, solid 185. And yet, all my life I've been watching